Okay, so we can start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, and this is, today is September 22nd. Okay, suddenly my mind went blank on the date. Okay, and we've been doing the Ratapala Sutta. This is the story about Ratapala. And of the Buddha's great disciples, there's a passage in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha declares certain disciples to be foremost or outstanding in particular qualities or particular areas of expertise. The Venerable Ratapala was declared the foremost of those who have gone forth, that has renounced the household life out of faith. And so the reason that he's declared foremost in this area probably is because he was so determined to go forth that in his family home he sat down or lay down on the floor and told his parents that he's going to remain here until he gets their permission to be ordained. Yeah, it's spicy, all right. Okay, so just to recapitulate where we were last week. So after Ratapala gets permission to go forth, then he's ordained as a monk by the Buddha, and he's gotten permission on the condition that at some point he'll go back to visit his parents. So then after some time, we're told, after a short time, or not before long, Ratapala becomes an arahat. And the commentary says that what's meant by in no long time is 12 years. So then he goes back to his hometown, which is some distance from the place where the Buddha usually teaches, probably about, could be 500, 600 miles, so it must be a long walk. And then when he reaches the town one morning, he's going on alms round, and his father is sitting on the veranda or the porch and sees him in the distance. And then when Ratapala comes in front of the father doesn't recognize him and just thinks that he's one of those dreadful followers of the ascetic Gautama who stole my son from me. And so his father abuses him and scolds him and denigrates him. And then Ratapala continues on his alms round, and he sees that a slave woman from the family is about to throw out some stale porridge, and he asks her to put it in his own alms bowl. Then the slave woman recognizes Ratapala by the marks of his hands, feet, and his voice. She reports this to the family. The parents are so joyful that they declare that the slave woman is now released from slavery. They invite Ratapala to come to the meal, for the meal the next day. And before Ratapala arrives, they've built up a large heap of gold and bullion, covered it with mats or with coverings. They've asked Ratapala's former wives to adorn themselves, to make themselves most beautiful. Okay, so then Ratapala comes to the family house. Now we're on page 682. And when he arrives and sits down, then his father uncovers the pile of gold and bullion and tells him, "This is your fortune. Come, give up this monk's life. Use this wealth to do meritorious deeds. You can give up the training, return to the low life, enjoy the wealth, and make merit." Then his father says to him, "If you would follow my advice, you should take this heap of gold, put it on carts, carry it away, and dump it in the river Ganges. Because by reason of this heap of gold, it will arise for you only sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair." Now, one question that I brought up last time, or that arose in the discussion, is whether some of the reports of this, the narration in the sutta, is reporting actual fact, you know, preserved historical fact, or whether part of it is a constructed narrative, maybe a fiction, or maybe it's at least details are filled in based on the imagination of the composers. Then one thing that struck me after the class, it would seem a little strange. It's on page 682. It's the passage which says that, okay, while the slave woman was putting the porridge in Ratapala's bowl, she recognized the characteristic features of his hands, his feet, and his voice. Then she goes to the mother and she says, "You should know, my lady, that Ratapala has arrived." Now, it would seem to me a really intriguing question. How would the narrator of the sutta know that the slave woman recognized Ratapala by the characteristics of his hands, feet, and voice? You know, when we think, okay, maybe she goes to the mother and tells the mother, "Ratapala has returned." But normally she wouldn't say, it doesn't seem so conceivable to me that she would go to the mother and say, "You know, lady, I've recognized the features of Ratapala's hands, feet, and his voice, so that must be him, that monk standing there." And even if she had reported it in that way, it seems unlikely that the mother is going to come back to Ratapala and say, "You know, Ratapala, the slave woman recognized you by the features of your hands, feet, and voice." She'd just be so excited that she'll say, "Ratapala, you've come back." Doesn't that seem to be the case? So it seems that the narrator is trying to make, even if there's a basic scaffolding of the story, which is historical fact, but it seems to me that the narrator is trying to make it maybe more interesting by filling in a detail like that. Did somebody read the Chinese version in the Agama? I'm not looking at you, Eva. You didn't? You? Okay. Okay. Does anybody have any comments on that or thoughts about that? I mean, I could be wrong, but it just seems to me improbable that this would get caught up in a narration that people are actually going to tell one another. Okay, Bowie has some comment. She could take the microphone.
Okay.
I speak more loudly. Yeah.
It's unreasonable. So what Bhante is trying to argue is probably it's also part of the narrator's voice. But after last week, I thought over it, and I think it's probably very consistent with the path of liberation, because even if those teeth of goats were used for good purpose, they would just be wholesome deeds,
yeah,
that will still trigger the future existence in the samsara world. So eventually they will still cause limitation grief.
Yeah.
Right. So they could be Ratnapala's true voice in advice.
Advising the father.
Right.
Yeah, that is possible, yeah. But that's not directly connected to the point that I brought up about...
I thought Bhante's point is to prove if this part is filled up by the narrator, then the advice of Ratnapala could be also another part.
No, I think that could be... historical fact, actual fact. But the other thing that struck me as a little bit strange last week that I mentioned was in the earlier part of the story, when Ratnapala is still a young man living at home, and then he makes the determination to go forth, when his parents failed to dissuade him from that purpose, then they ask his friends and companions to go try to persuade him. But there's no mention there of his wives. They don't send his wives to go to persuade him. But later, when he returns home, then they tell, the parents tell his wives to adorn themselves in the way that Ratnapala thought that they were beautiful. And so suddenly there's a mention of wives, not mentioned in the earlier part of the story. Again, that seems a little peculiar to me. But some of the explanations that came up last week in the discussion seemed to provide some basis for believing that Ratnapala could indeed have been married, but just the wives weren't sent on the scene because at that point they wouldn't have had the authority to persuade him to give up his idea of going forth. Okay, so let's now continue with the rest of the sutta. Okay, so after Ratnapala rejects the gold, now we're starting the next section. This is section 23. So now Ratnapala's former wives come up to him and they grasp his feet. And then they say to him, "What are they like, my lord's son, the nymphs for whose sake you lead the holy life?" Okay, so this was maybe a belief in some quarters of ancient India that the reason that you lead that you renounce the world and lead the spiritual life, that you renounce the sensual pleasures in this life, so that you'll be able to get a heap of merit and be reborn in one of those heavenly worlds where the devas there, the male devas, are surrounded by a harem of, 20 beautiful, they call them apsaras, or nymphs. And so we have some of these legendary figures, like, the rishis with the big beards, the long flowing hair, clad in just the loincloth, sitting in the forest under the tree, their bodies, just bone and skin. But when they're sitting there meditating, what they're meditating on are the beautiful damsels that they'll be able to enjoy when they get reborn in one of the celestial heavenly worlds. So apparently the wives of Ratapala must have believed that he was living this life of renunciation in order to be reborn in one of these heavens and be able to enjoy the company of these celestial nymphs. So then Ratapala replies, "We do not lead the holy life for the sake of the nymphs, sisters." So now he's calling them sisters. And when they hear that, then they cry out and they faint. It seems, I don't know, one has to have some understanding of maybe the woman's psychology to know why they would faint if they were called sisters. I mean, if Ratapala was living at home as, you know, their husband, and then one day he started to call them sisters, one could see that they would think it rather strange, but now he's come as a monk, so why should they faint?
I think that's the final rejection of them as wives.
Okay. So Barbara says that she thinks that this is putting like the sort of stamp of definiteness, the final rejection on their status as wives. Okay, Richard? Okay, pass the microphone back to Richard.
And also, people are able to class other people in their family very easily. As you simply say, you call someone a sister, and then that means you're committed to treating them as a sister, and it's all incest rules apply. And that allows the women to relax entirely and be informal and all that because there's no threat of sexual relations.
Yeah.
So it's really a very absolute. And it's done verbally, and it's done without backing by the state, because it's basically the family that really is the only working institution.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very strong difference. Indian women are very shocked to be entered into one category when they think they're in the other.
Yeah, so Richard says in brief that when he calls them sisters, it marks a very like drastic, radical change in their status. So now it means that once he calls them sisters, that any possibility of a sexual relationship is completely out of bounds. Perhaps they, well, I would have been hoping this was like their last hope to drag him back to the household life. And now when he calls them sisters, it means that there's no possibility of a Sukhi. Whenever what?
Whenever they have like some kind of surprising kind of story or any like shocking story, even now a lot of women just faint.
They faint.
Yes. they probably in their mind they need to faint or whatever. But I see a lot of women like when they have like. Children doing something really horrible.
Yeah.
Instead of being reasonable and talking,
First
they just faint. So it could be just very simple, like a description of what happens. That's the way I think.
But it certainly it has to do something with his labeling them as sisters, because the text says that they call out, "Our Lord Ratapala calls us sisters," then they cry and faint. Okay, so anyway, let's continue. Okay, so it seems Ratapala now, though he's an arhat, he's getting a little impatient with all of these sort of tricks that the family is trying to play on him. First, they try to lure him away from the monk's life with money, with gold. Then they try to seduce him back to the household life with the former wives dressed up beautifully. So now he says to his father, "Householder, if there is a meal to be given, then give it, but don't harass me. Okay, so finally the family relents and they present Ratapala with his meal. Then when he finishes the meal, then he just puts his bowl away, he stands up, and he utters some stanzas, which it seems are mainly addressed, or at least they're referring to the former wives. And I have to say, you know, the way sometimes, like, when there's a news report to take place, maybe if there's been a suicide attack in Iraq or Afghanistan, before the report comes, they say some of the pictures that you're about to see are unpleasant. So if you feel sensitive about these matters, please don't attend to this report. So if you feel rather sensitive about some of the lines that I'm going to read out in the verses, please close your ears or don't read them. Okay. Behold a puppet here pranked out. The puppet is referring to, I guess, to the wives who have been decked up beautifully. A body built up out of sores, sick, an object for concern, where no stability abides. Behold a figure here pranked out, with jewelry and earrings too, a skeleton wrapped up in skin, made attractive by its clothes. Its feet adorned with henna dye, I think it's a kind of red dye that you still see it in India in the villages, women put it on the feet. Here in the West, women put the, call it nail polish on the toenails. But in India, they put this henna dye, they put decorative patterns on the feet. So its feet adorned with henna dye and powder, face powder smeared upon its face. It may beguile a fool, but not a seeker of the further shore. Its hair is dressed in eightfold plaits. Maybe a little allusion there to the Noble Eightfold Path is a counterfoil to that. An unguent smeared upon its eyes, it may beguile a fool, but not a seeker of the further shore. A filthy body well adorned, like new painted unguent pot, it may beguile a fool, but not a seeker of the further shore. The deer hunter set out the snare. The snare was the gold and the former wives. But the deer, that's Ratapala, did not spring the trap. We ate the bait and now depart, leaving the hunters to lament. Very powerful verses. What do you think? I see Sandy is sort of shriveling up her face a little bit. To make you more comfortable, I have to tell you that if there's some tendency in early Buddhism that I don't really resonate so well, it's with this disparagement of the body. It seems to me to be taking things to an extreme.
I'm struck by the cruelty. I'm sure he didn't. I mean, if he's an arhat, he couldn't have meant to be cruel.
Yeah.
That couldn't have been the intention.
But
that's how it is made. Okay, you learned your lesson that we're all sores and skeletons.
But don't inflict it on us. It might be the case, again, that. Well, I think these verses do come, you know, there's a collection called the Theragata in the Pali Canon. It has a counterpart in the Chinese Tripitaka. These are the collected verses of the elders There's the Theragatha, the verses of the elder monks, the Therigatha, the verses of the elder nuns, and within the Theragatha there's a section for Ratapala, and these verses are included amongst Ratapala's verses there. So there seems to be at least a correspondence between the text of the Majjhima Nikaya and Ratapala's verses in the Theragatha. It's possible that Ratapala actually didn't speak them on this occasion, but he spoke them, well, they do seem to fit the situation. No, I don't know. But I would say, again, I'm putting Venerable Ananda in this situation, Venerable Sariputta. I don't think they would speak hard verses like this, but they would say, sisters, let me teach you the Dhamma. And then they'll start with a graduated teaching. You know, start speaking about the benefits of giving, generosity, about the benefits of sila or moral observance, and then gradually build up and then come to the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path. But also, it's just possible that these are the verses that Ratapala spoke, and maybe he saw that these women had really fixed delusions about their own beauty, and maybe pride and conceit based on their beauty. One would think that if they were really proud, they would have, especially if it were 12 years, I don't think that they would hang around in the parents-in-law home. But they would try to gain some kind of release from the marital ties in order to seek another husband. I remember there's a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where there is a young man who has, I think it was four wives. He's a young man with four young wives, and he goes to hear the Buddha preach. And as when the Buddha gives his discourse, this young man, on the spot of the moment, he becomes a non-returner, an anagami, not bound to come back to this world, which means that he's cut off craving for sensual pleasures. And when he becomes a non-returner, then he takes what are called the five precepts, with celibacy as the fifth, which means that he takes the precept in which complete sexual abstinence replaces avoiding or abstaining from sexual misconduct. Then when he goes home, he calls his four wives to him and he says, my dears, I've now become a disciple of the Buddha and I've taken these precepts with celibacy as one of the precepts. So I now release you from the marital bonds you had to me. If you want, you can go home to your parents. If you want to get married to another man, you can go off to that other man. Or if you want to stay here at home and live the celibate life as me, you can do so. And then the women make different decisions. And so it would seem to me that unless they were living for 12 years in the really strong hope that Ratapala would return to them and then become their husband again. But if it didn't work out after 1 or 2 years, I think that they would come to their senses and realize that he's not going to come back. Anybody have any ideas about that?
They have son together?
Excuse me?
They have son or daughter together?
No mention is made of them having any children.
Although I think they really are being kept in the lap of luxury. That has to be.
That's possible too.
Yeah,
because it's the leading family. Yeah, it's the leading family in this town. Yeah. Okay, Richard has some comment. Use the microphone, please.
A little bit, I think.
Yeah.
path and followed by some of the upper castes, is that the woman is not to remarry at all, ever. There's supposed to be one woman for each man,
mm-hmm.
and that's all that is among some castes. And so it depends, I think, partly on what caste it is,
yeah.
And how religious.
Yeah. Yeah, and also I don't know whether that regulation would have already been observed in the time of the Buddha. I wonder that might have come in the work that, you know, the law, the Hindu law books, like the laws of Manu,
yeah.
Which do come from a somewhat later, several centuries later.
Well, and Bedford wrote long essays about this, that the Hindus generally refuted, but he, there's one of the reasons that Hindus hate Dan Bedford so much. And Baker, of course, actually converted to Buddhism in 1957, but he has a lot of writing on this. So it may simply be that they believed that they were forbidden to remarry. But also, as a consequence of that, there is a very strong tradition in India, too, that aunties are always available. That is, women are not supposed to remarry after their husbands die. That's when they become aunties and they're supposed to stay in the back room and not have any relations with anyone. But everyone knows they do.
Oh, I see. I see. But I don't. This seems to be a wealthy, prestigious family. I don't know whether the family would allow the former wives to become aunties.
The wealth of the family often would argue for that there's often tied to rigidity of religious practice in many parts of India. So the wealth was considered. You have the goddess Lakshmi and so on.
Mm.
So wealth was considered a godly thing. In the way that Calvinists considered.
Yeah. Anyway, coming back to sort of the tone, this kind of tone, this way of looking at the body, it seems to me one has to look at the body in, you know, from at least two perspectives. And I have to say, when I was living in Sri Lanka, I did my share of not going to the charnel grounds, which they don't have anymore, but we used to go, it became like the in thing for the monks to do is to go to the hospitals, have the morgues. And usually the doctors who are working in the morgues are devout Sinhalese Buddhists, and so when monks come, they allow them to come in and to observe the autopsies. And so I've seen a fair number of autopsies, you know, maybe four or five times. You know, they have the body is kept in a kind of box, and they open up the box, and they take out the body, and they put it on the table. It looks like it's 100% alive. You know, the guy's not moving around, but seems like he's in a deep sleep. Then the doctor will take up the scalpel and put it to the skin, and I'm almost about ready to scream out, "Don't cut him like that!" But he'll cut it open the body, and they take out the parts, and they know the 32 parts mentioned in the classical texts. So it'll take out those parts which are tangible, concrete and tangible. Like, this is the heart, here's the large intestine, these are the small intestines, this is the liver. Could you show me the spleen, please? Okay, there's the spleen. Then the most sensitive part is where they cut open the scalp, then they have to they cut the skin of the scalp, then they have to use some kind of saw, it's like a little saw, and they cut open the skull, and then they take out the brains. I remember one time I went with this English monk who had been living like a really rigorous ascetic type of life, you know, not staying fixed at any monastery, but always walking from place to place. And somehow we met up in Colombo and we both decided to go to the morgue to observe an autopsy that day. And we were standing there watching it, and this rather ascetic temperament, this monk with an ascetic temperament said to the doctor, "Do you have a as we were watching, he said, "Do you have a chair I could sit on?" I'm feeling a little faint. Yeah, but okay, so from one angle one could see that the impression of the body as being beautiful and attractive does rely to a great extent on illusion or projections. But there's also something, I would say, that's marvelous and extremely intelligent about the working of the body, the way all the different organs and tissues function together with a great deal of harmony to take care of all of the functions. Like if I get a cut on my skin, you know, I don't really have to pay much attention to it. Maybe I just put a little antiseptic on, but I don't have to control it. It'll just grow the right kind of cells by itself and the wound will heal. The heart is beating, you know, it's a terrific worker. You know, if anybody should get paid a CEO's salary, it's the heart that's beating away. How many times? Maybe 70 to, excuse me?
100,000 times a day.
You figured it out. I was going to say 70 to 100 times a minute. You multiply that by the number of minutes a day, every day of our life. Wow, we go to sleep. The heart doesn't sleep. And then when we have to figure out a problem, or recognize a figure, or write a paper, prepare a speech, all of the brain cells are working together. We have to do the thinking, but the brain cells provide the manpower that sees that all of these mental functions can take place. And when we go for a walk, we don't have to tell the muscles to move in coordination. We just say, "I'm going to walk," and we could be speaking with a friend, thinking about a musical tune, trying to memorize a passage from the suttas, but just be mindful of walking, and the brain, nervous system, muscle system, bones are all working in this marvelous, marvelous process of coordination. Okay, so anyway, this is Ratapala now expressing his perspective on the body to his former wives. And perhaps, you know, it's just possible that when his former wives heard this is the kind of thing that the commentary would say, as they heard this, they became stream enterers, or once returners, or non-returners. Okay, so then Ratapala leaves his family, and then he goes to this garden. It's called Meghachira Garden. It's the garden where the deer are dwelling. And it belongs to this king. Apparently this must be the king of this particular region, named Kauravya. So the king addresses his gamekeeper to go and tidy up the garden so that we may go there for our pleasure. And as the king is as the gamekeeper is cleaning up the garden, he sees the Venerable Ratapala sitting there for the day's meditation. And then, this is interesting, the gamekeeper somehow recognizes Ratapala. You know, the father didn't recognize him, but the gamekeeper recognizes him, and says that he reports to the king and says, "While I was cleaning up the garden, I saw that the clansman Ratapala is there, the son of the leading clan in this town of Tulakotita, of whom you have always spoken highly. He's sitting at the foot of the tree for his day's abiding." Again, it's peculiar. The gamekeeper recognizes Ratapala, and the king has been speaking about him highly. Of course, the 12 years is, that information comes from the commentary, which can be exaggerating the time period. So suppose it's not 12 years, but maybe 2 or 3 years that Ratapala was away, for the gamekeeper to recognize him, for the servant woman at home to recognize him. We could see that the father might not recognize him because he's forming this judgment from a distance, and his anger and resentment could blind him to an accurate perception of Ratapala. But I would think for the gamekeeper to recognize him, it can't be after 12 years. It would have to be a much shorter period.
That is, the Buddha does not share in the caste system, and he doesn't share prejudice against women. He also admits untouchables. And so he also thinks that people on the bottom of society are often more perceptive, more intelligent than people higher up in society. I think that this is the observation about the servant recognizing him and the gamekeeper recognizing him are both assertions that the people at the bottom are actually more perceptive than the people on top.
Yeah, that I don't really know whether there's a kind of an underlying agenda like that in the sutta. I mean, it might be the case in actual fact. Did Barbara, you were going to say something?
That they aren't blinded the way the father is. I mean, the father has a thing about blind, bald-pated recluses. Every time he sees one, that's what he gets. Yeah. So he doesn't notice that his son is inside the school.
But the relationship is repeated with the king and the game and the gamekeeper. That is, there's the same relationship between the king and the gamekeeper that there is between the father and the servant. Right? That is, the servant and the gamekeeper both know who the father is, and the father, the servant and the gamekeeper, and the father and the king both don't know him.
Well, no, there's a difference here in that the father actually saw Ratapala in the distance, but didn't recognize him. The king hasn't yet been exposed to Ratapala.
Okay.
Apparently the king, he might have seen Ratapala years earlier when Ratapala was just a young man, but then he might not have, he wouldn't have paid any attention. He's just, a kid or a young man in this town. But when he heard the report that Ratapala, the son of this most wealthiest, most prestigious family in the town, had renounced to become an ascetic, that would have made a strong impression on him. And so he came to have a high opinion of Ratapala. And maybe reports came through that Ratapala was living a very pure life and became an arahant, a holy one.
Well, there's also a thing that the people at the top of society are more dependent upon communications with others.
That is true.
And reputation and word. Being able to act through others at a distance than the people at the bottom who are often more perceptive about their own impressions. Rely less on reputation because people don't talk to them as much, and so they have to form their own opinion.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, Suki was going to say something. Wait, take the microphone. I mean, this is the way it works in a stratified society. This is also what Richard was pointing out, that the people who are sort of exposed to the buzz of events will be people on the ground level, And they report it up the chain of command till it comes up to the people at the top. Okay, let's go on because I want to cover what is really the heart of the sutta, which is Ratapala's discourse to the king. Okay, so when the king hears this, then he has the chariots prepared, he drives to the park in order to pay homage to Ratapala, and probably with the hope of asking him some questions and getting a discourse from him. And it's interesting, when the king approaches Ratapala, he presents him with what's called an elephant rug. Perhaps it's a rug made originally from elephant skin. And he asks Ratapala to sit down on it, but Ratapala refuses and says, he just invites the king to sit down, and he says, "I don't need the elephant seat, I'm sitting on my own mat." This would be a sitting cloth that monks used to, well, they still carry around when they were traveling. They have this cloth that they would spread out, because if they're sitting on the ground, they don't want to get the robe soiled with the mud and dirt of the ground, the moisture from the dew. So they put the sitting cloth out. Okay, now on page 685, we come to what we call the heart of the discourse. And here, the king says to Ratapala, he says, there are four kinds of loss that people undergo, four kinds of disappointment that make them miserable. And it's because of this that some people shave off their hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. What are these four? There's loss through aging, loss through sickness, the loss of wealth, and the loss of relatives. Then the king is going to explain each of these. The loss through aging means when somebody grows old, they consider, now I've become an old person, I'm in the last stage of life, no point striving to acquire more wealth, so let me shave off my hair and my beard and go forth and become an ascetic. This had become actually one of the practices that was absorbed into the Hindu system, called the four ashramas, the four stages of life. When you're a young man, you go off, you observe brahmacharya or celibacy, you go find a teacher, and you study under the teacher. The Brahmins would learn the Vedas, young men in professions would study under a teacher to learn their profession. So maybe this would be from the age of 12 to 24. Then, when you become supposedly 24, then you enter the next stage, the stage of the householder, where you marry, you beget a family, you bring up the family, till the children are grown up and can become independent. Then you enter on the third stage, which is called vanaprastha, which means setting out for the forest. So you set out, they say, for the forest, which still means that you can live at home, but you simplify your home, you take up the observance of celibacy, even though your wife can be living at home, and you undertake religious practices, religious study, practice of meditation. And then comes the last stage, when you reach old age. Say about 60 or so. I'm over 60, and I am old age. The last stage is called the stage of sannyasa. It's the stage of complete renunciation, where you give up any kind of fixed abode, and you're supposed to just take the begging bowl and wander around all year round, except for the 3 months of the rainy season. Okay, so this seems to be referring to that, these old men who renounce in old age. Okay, but Ratapala, he says, you have left home when you were just a young man in the prime of youth, endowed with all of the blessings of youth. So then he asks the question, what have you known or seen that you have gone forth into homelessness? Okay, then the second question, or second point, is loss through sickness. So somebody is afflicted, becomes ill, and through their illness, they become disillusioned with the worldly life. And so then they think no more point in acquiring wealth. When you get sick, you cannot use your wealth for anything. So then they give up, probably when they recover their health, then they give up the household life and to go into homelessness. But he points out that Ratapala all along has been healthy, strong, free from all illness and affliction. I don't know how the king knows about Ratapala's digestive system. But this is a fixed formula that always comes in the text to indicate somebody is in good health. So it's just probably just filling in here this formula on the digestive system.
More than 50% of deaths in India still are from intestinal disease.
Yeah, maybe so.
Water is so bad, sanitation is so bad.
Yeah. Okay, then the third is the loss of wealth. Somebody has great wealth, many possessions. Then suddenly, it says, gradually their wealth dwindles away. Or nowadays with stock market, it could be like we had in the Great Depression, somebody, all of their wealth disappears overnight. So then they think that, now I've lost all my wealth. It's very difficult to build up my wealth again, so I might as well go forth and become a monk. Then I have all of my material needs taken care of. I get a nice cottage. I get my food for the day. If I get sick, there'll be people solicitors for my well-being who will provide me with medical treatment. And so he goes forth because of loss of wealth. And then the fourth reason is But Ratapala's family has always been wealthy, so this doesn't apply to him. Okay, so then comes the fourth reason why some go forth, and that is that somebody has many friends, companions, relatives, and so on, and gradually those relatives pass away or move elsewhere, and so he finds himself almost all alone in the world. You might have wife, husband, children, many friends. And then as you get older, of course, the children grow up, one moves to California, another moves to Texas, another moves to Montana, Washington, Utah. Maybe wife passes away, or husband dies, or family relationship turns sour. And then as you get older, Joe passed away, Jane passed away last week, till you find, all of the friends are gone. Like, it strikes me with my father, he's 96 now, and all of his old friends, none of them are alive anymore. And now I'm grown up, my sister's grown up, of course we're living not so far, but his brother has passed away, his sisters have passed away, his wife, my mother, has passed away. So there's really nobody there. But he doesn't think of going forth. Okay, so when you find yourself all alone in the world, then you think, okay, let me go forth into homelessness. But Ratapala had many friends and companions, relatives and so on, right here in this town, so he didn't suffer loss of relatives. So why have you gone forth? What have you seen? What have you heard? What have you known on the basis of which that you've gone forth into homelessness? Now what comes following this will give us the clue as to why, when Ratapala was just a young man sitting in the audience, when the Buddha, when he heard, first met the Buddha and heard the Buddha gives that discourse to the community, suddenly the idea came into his mind, let me go forth and become a monk. So, and then Ratapala was insistent that, so far as I understand the teaching of the Buddha, it's not possible for one who lives at home to truly live the perfectly pure spiritual life for making an end of suffering. So now Ratapala is going to explain his understanding of the Dharma. So he says that there are four ways of summing up the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees. And so when I knew these and saw them in the sense of deeply understood them, then, actually I would put the sequence, when I heard them, knew them, and saw their truth for myself, then I went forth from the home life into homelessness. So what are these four summaries of the Dhamma, or four principles? First, it said that this world is unstable. It's swept away. So that is the first summary. The second is that the world has no shelter and no protector. The third, that in this world there is nothing that one can truly call one's own, that one has to leave behind everything and pass on. That's the third summary. And then the fourth is that the world is incomplete, insatiable, the slave of craving. So when I heard and knew and deeply saw into the truth of that fourth principle, then I went forth from the home life into homelessness. So now the king asks Ratapala about each of these principles or summaries of the Dhamma. So we come paragraph or section 38. The king says that, Ratapala, you have said that the world is unstable, it is swept away. How should the meaning of this statement be understood? And now Ratapala is going to come very much down to earth, so to speak, and speak to the king very directly in terms of his own experience. What can a king experience in his own life that's going to bring the truth of the Dhamma home to his own heart? You know, he's not going to be speaking abstract teachings like these are the five aggregates, these are the 12 links of dependent origination, this is how the sense faculties interact with sense objects to give rise to consciousness, to give rise to contact, feeling, and so on. But he's going to speak, you know, in very concrete terms that the king can just reflect back on his own living experience and see that these principles can be confirmed from his own experience. Apparently this king is somewhat older. In fact, you will see that he's actually probably quite old. So Ratapala says, "What do you think, O king, when you were 20 or 25 years old, weren't you an expert rider of elephants, of horses? You were an expert charioteer, expert in archery, in swordsmanship. You had strong thighs, strong arms, and you were capable in battle." So this king would have been trained as a prince in all of the military arts so that he would be able to be a strong and courageous and capable leader of his state. So the king says, "Yes, in fact, I was so strong and so powerful that sometimes I wondered if I had supernormal power then. At that time, I didn't see anybody who could equal me in strength. So then Ratapala asked the king, "Are you now as strong in thighs and arms, as sturdy and capable as before?" And then the king confesses, "No, Ratapala, now I'm," and again this is a stock passage on old age, "I'm old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage, my years have turned 80. So he's 80 years old. "Sometimes," and this is really very concrete and picturesque, "sometimes I mean to put my foot here, and my foot winds up someplace else." You know, if you've ever seen sometimes an old person walking. They get up and lift the foot, and then involuntarily it slips off to the side. And they lift up the other foot, intending to put it there, and it goes off to the side. It's true, it happens. Okay, so this is the meaning of, Ratapala says, this is the meaning of that summary of the Dhamma, that the world is unstable, it is swept away. Excuse me. Now, I think this line comes from, at least it's alluding to a verse that occurs in the Samyutta Nikaya, very early in the Devata Samyutta, one of the first verses, that the world is unstable, it is swept away, it's being swept towards old age and death. Seeing this, like seeing this danger in life of the world, one should do deeds of merit that bring happiness. That is the verse the Deva speaks to the Buddha. And then the Buddha sort of corrects the Deva. The Deva was speaking correctly on what you call the mundane level. That's the level of doing meritorious deeds. But then the Buddha corrects the Deva and says, life is unstable, it is swept away, one is being driven towards old age and death. Seeing this danger in life in the world, the seeker of peace should not grasp the world's bait. So the Buddha here, he's pointing towards not doing deeds of merit, but not becoming attached to the worldly enjoyments. Of course, even the seeker of merit, or the one who does merit, seeking happiness, is still seeking some kind of mundane or worldly happiness. But the one who wants liberation realizes that even the mundane happiness that will come in the heavenly world through merits, even that is unstable and swept away. Okay, so when Ratapala speaks this, then the king says, "Wonderful, wonderful, marvelous, how well that has been expressed by the Buddha, the Blessed One." And then he moves on to the next summary of the Dhamma. He says, and each time the king now, he's trying to present sort of a counterexample to, in a way that's disproving Ratapala's statement, but then Ratapala is going to come back with a counter-counter-example which shows that the Buddha's summary of Dhamma is actually true and the king's assumption is invalid. So the king says, "Master Ratapala, there exist in this court," these are, I think, the four parts of the Indian army, elephant troops, cavalry, chariot troops, and infantry, and they can conquer any threats to us. But you say that in the world there is no shelter and no protector. So aren't you wrong about that? Because we have protectors. We have these branches of the army to protect us. So now Ratapala is going to give his own counterexample. He says, what do you think, O king? Do you have any kind of chronic illness? And the king says, oh, I do have a chronic illness, Ratapala. I have this chronic headache condition. And so whenever I'm to give a class on Saturday, the students have to call in to inquire whether the class will take place. No, I'm sorry, that's the wrong text. But the king says, I have a chronic wind ailment, Master Ratapala. So maybe it's something like asthma. Because sometimes when he gets that ailment, then all of his friends and relatives gather around him, thinking that now the king is about to die, now the king is about to die. But probably that they call a doctor who gives him some emergency treatment, and then he recovers. Okay, now the Buddha says, Ratapala says, what do you think, O king? Can you command your friends and relatives? Come, O my friends, all of you present, share this painful feeling of mine so that I feel less pain. Or do you have to feel that pain all by yourself alone? And so then the king says, I can't ask my friends and relatives to take my pain on themselves, but I have to feel it all alone. Like whenever I get my bad headache, even I have many friends for some, now it's been 25, 30 years, they say, oh, Bhante, we so wish that we could take your pain upon ourselves, but not possible. Everybody has to undergo their own pain. If you get any real serious illness, cancer, stroke, heart disease, of course doctors can do something to ameliorate the condition, but nobody can take the pain. We each have to feel our own pain. And so this is one way in which it can be said that this world has no shelter and no protector. We can do things to protect ourselves, you know, eat healthy food, don't eat junk food, take vitamins, get exercise every day, see a doctor, at least, you know, have a doctor's appointment for a general checkup once a year. So those are, you could say, temporary protective measures. But when the time comes, when either external conditions or our karma conditions all aggregate, come together, flow together, then we're going to come up with some illness. It might be this year, next year, in the distant future. Even if you get, you know, the regular flu or bad cold. When I get a bad cold, I feel so miserable. I think, oh, this is terrible, it's torture. But it always goes away after a week. But you get some real persistent chronic illness, and you realize that, you know, there's nothing that can be done to alleviate it. So you feel like you have no protector anymore. Of course, we always have as the ultimate protection the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and the path. Okay, now we come to the third summary of the Dhamma. Okay, now the king is going to give the counterexample. So, because Ratapala has said that life, or that in the world there's nothing that we can call our own, but we have to leave all and pass on. And so the king points out that, especially in this court, we have abundant gold coins and bullion, that's blocks of gold, stored away in our vaults and in our lofts. And probably the king said, and in your family, there's abundant gold and silver. So how could you say that we have nothing that's our own? Even though we might not have abundant gold and silver, but we have a nice home, a good bank account, maybe you own some stocks and other securities, you have a nice car, good furniture in your home. So do you think, this is mine, this all belongs to me? But how could you say that this isn't my own? So Ratapala now gives his counter-argument. He says, what do you think, great king? Now you enjoy yourself with the five objects of sensual pleasure, but will you be able to have this in the life to come so that you can just think to yourself, let me in the future enjoy these same five cords or objects of sensual pleasure? Can you get your home back, your car back, your furniture, everything you cherish, can you get it back? Or will others take over this property, which you will have to pass on, and you will have to pass on in accordance with your karma, your actions? Then the king admits, I cannot, even though I'm a powerful king, but I can't just lay down the rule, the law. This is my royal command. When I die, you hold all of this property for me in the next life, then I'll come back and take over this property. Maybe the Tibetan lamas can do that. Because then, they go looking, they keep the mala and the Dharma throne and even the room when the old Rinpoche passes away. Then they go seeking the boy. A few years later, they go seeking a boy who will recognize the mala, who shows some kind of memory of his previous life. Then they bring him back to the old monastery where he was the abbot, and they present him back to his room, and everything comes back to him. But for us ordinary people, that's not possible. And this is one of the themes, useful themes, in the meditation on death. And so the way some of the commentators explain it, and I found this useful to practice myself, is to think of the three things to take this theme, that there's nothing that's our own, we have to pass on and leave everything behind. I think of it in terms of three aspects. First thing that we have to give up when we pass away are all of our material possessions, including actually not only material things, but even intangible possessions like name and fame, reputation, status, position. All of this has to be given up when we die. So somebody can be the CEO of General Electric, General Motors, like Steve Jobs, the CEO of Apple Computers, just in his 50s, passes on, and who does Apple Computers belong to now? Steve Jobs, just a corpse, no more position as the CEO of Apple Computers. So we have to give up all of these, we call these material acquisitions. Second thing we have to give up are all our friends and relatives. So the mother has to give up her children, father has to give up his children. Sometimes, if the child is to die first, the child has to give up mother and father, brothers and sisters, all of our friends, our colleagues, our teachers, our students. Everyone has to separate. And what is the third thing that we have to give up when we die? Exactly. Our bodies. So now we say that this body is mine. Now I'm beautiful, now I'm handsome, now I'm strong and healthy, even if I'm weak and ugly and sickly, but still, even the man who has lying on the bed with maybe a terminal cancer and a lot of pain still clings to the body as mine, mine. But if one meditates in this way a little bit every day, I have to give up all material acquisitions, have to give up all my dear relatives and friends, have to give up even this body, then one becomes sort of detached from these things. Which doesn't mean that one becomes cold and indifferent. One could still enjoy one's possessions, enjoy one's friends, and still take care of one's body. But when the time comes to pass away, one could just let the body go, let everything go peacefully. Okay, then the last one, we come to the fourth one, the one that's, this is quite interesting one. Here the king doesn't give a counterexample, but he simply says, Master Ratapala has said that the world is incomplete, insatiable, the slave of craving. How should the meaning of this statement be understood? And now Ratapala, again, he's going to use the king's own experience. He says, what do you think, great king? Do you reign over the Kuru country? That's the northern part of India. The king, the king said, excuse me. The king says, of course I do, that's my kingdom. Then Ratapala says, suppose a trustworthy man, a messenger, came from the east and said to you, you should know, great king, I've come from the east, and there I saw a large country, powerful, rich, crowded with people. There's plenty of elephants there, plenty of cavalry and so on, plenty of ivory, gold, bullion, plenty of women for wives, but your army is strong enough to conquer it. If you want, just go ahead, and it's yours. So what are you going to do? So the king will say, I'm satisfied with one realm, that's enough for me. Why do I need the eastern country? You know, nowadays it's like saying, well, actually, this is what's going on. You know, the ice of the Arctic is melting. You know, it's reached the great, the greatest extent of ice melting in all of history. We should be in a panic. The world is changing. But what are the CEOs of the oil companies and the gas companies thinking? We have to change our, you know, sources of energy. We can't let this go on. No, they're thinking, wow, new opportunity has opened up. We can now go digging in the, drilling in the Arctic and get new sources of oil, new sources of natural gas. So this is the way the world is insatiable, a slave to craving. So the king is going to think, when he hears this, when he's asked this question, what would you do? He says, we would conquer it and rule over it, Ratapala. You think I'm a fool? Of course I'll conquer it. Okay, then the same thing happens, the west, north, east. We did the east with the west, north, south, even from across the sea. They say there's this realm there, you could conquer it. What are you going to do? I'll conquer it. Take possession of it. You know, he might, in the battle, he might lose, you know, 10,000 men. Innocent men might be killed on his side. maybe 20,000 on the enemy side, 30,000 people dead. What does it matter? There's to the king, there's wealth there, there's ivory, gold, women for wives. So he's never satisfied. Okay, so each time the Ratapala gives his explanation, the king rejoices, and then Ratapala sums up and says that this, when I heard this and knew it and saw it for myself, then I went forth from the home life into homelessness. Okay, and then after Ratapala gave this explanation, then he spoke these verses. Basically, the verses are pretty much just stating in verse form the principles that he's already explained. So I won't go through the verses here, but you can read the verses on your own. But just now I'll ask if there's any questions about this or any comments. Okay, then we'll stop for the morning, and then we'll break for the lunch now, and then we can come back, say about 12:10, we could have a discussion period. And I should say that next week we'll be having the class in the library, because they're going to be doing the 7-day ceremony here. It's the Yang Wang Bao Chan, the Emperor Wang's Jewel Repentance Ceremony. If anybody wants to participate in that, it will be going on all week, starting tonight. Okay, so we'll come back at about 12:10. And here I brought some books from my friend Venerable Analeo. Remember, he was here in June, some of you. These are the Baos had printed two books of short essays by Venerable Analeo that had been published separately, called Excursions into the Thought World of the Pali Discourses. So now these, both of these booklets have been combined into one, and they've been, some of them have been sent to me for free distribution. So I'm going to put them maybe on the front table here, this table, and anybody who wants can take a copy. And they are very good, very short, but very, very scholarly essays on different themes that occur in the Nikayas. Okay, so let us end with the sharing the merits, verses to share the merits. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Udipa Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang Etavatacham Hehi Padang Punyasampadang Sabbe Devanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Etavatacham Hehi Sampadang Punyasampadang Sabbe Bhutanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Etavatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Satanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Pavag Upadaya Avici Hetato Etantare Satakayu Papana Rupiya Rupicha Sanya Sanino Dukha Pamuchantu Pusantu Nibhuting. Yeah, then next week we do the Angulimala Sutta. That's another sutta that uses a narrative framework in order to convey the, its message. So again, we'll be exploring that sutta for the sort of underlying message that's coming through the narration.